Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Would you like to escape into the British countryside for encounters with the wild world? The podcast from BBC Countryfile magazine is a weekly adventure into beautiful landscapes to meet wildlife, discuss the big nature stories with guests, and find welcome tranquility in a busy world. We take you on thrilling quests and charming rambles so that you can enjoy the great outdoors wherever you are. So join me, Fergus Collins, each week as we escape into the great British countryside together. Search for the podcast and follow us to never miss an episode.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 20th of June, these are our main stories. An investigation is published into abuses of students at the height of the Syrian civil war. Hundreds of people are reported to have died during this year's Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia as temperatures in Mecca exceeded 50 degrees. Scientists have shed light on why some people don't get COVID-19 in a study which may pave the way for new treatments. Also in this podcast,
I deliberately write clues that will have things like Beyonce or One Direction in them. I want someone who glances at it in their paper to think, oh, I thought it was all Shakespeare and Greek myths.
We enter the notoriously tricky world of cryptic crosswords. Should they be revamped to attract younger problem solvers? There are thousands of accounts of human rights abuses carried out during Syria's civil war. Many of the most brutal cases took place in Aleppo between 2011 and 2013. Now, a report published by the campaign group Syrian British Consortium concludes that one of the country's top sporting officials was responsible for many of the abuses. He's Omar Al-Aroub. He is now chairman of the country's Paralympic Committee, but at the time he was a senior member of the regime-aligned National Union of Syrian Students, a group that reportedly beat and tortured opposition groups. Our Middle East regional editor Mike Thompson has this report, and a warning, you may find some of the details upsetting.
As anti-government protests by Syrian students grew in intensity, so did the crackdown against them.
The order was to use brute force against any student activism. For example, we were ordered to detain a student and beat him on his genitals to leave him impotent.
Nidal wasn't in the security services. He was a student at Aleppo University, a member of the regime-affiliated National Union of Syrian Students, or NUSS, whose job was to terrorise campus activists opposed to President Assad. He refused to join in the brutality and later left the group, but says many others revelled in the violence.
The NUSS member who inflicted the most harm was considered a good member in the eyes of the NUSS and would obtain benefits in the future.
On May the 2nd, 2012, members of the student union stormed the students' residence of Aleppo University and threw students from the sixth floor to the ground.
Yamen was also a student at Aleppo University.
On May the 21st, 2013, the Faculty of Science was stormed and I was arrested while sitting my exams. I was tortured, including by beating, electric shocks, and starvation.
Yasmin Nalawi, who led the Syrian British Consortium's investigation into the NUSS, says that while the sight of Syrian security forces beating protesters in the street or bombing homes is sadly familiar to many, what happened on campuses is probably not.
People are used to seeing or even documenting evidence of massacres, aerial bombardments, chemical weapons and the like. But this investigation truly shows how every single institution within Syria was weaponized against the Syrian people.
Syria's delegation to the Paris Olympics next month is likely to include Omar Al-Aroub, chair of the country's Sports Federation and Paralympics Committee. He previously held a senior role in the NUSS, first in Aleppo and then nationally. A prospect Yasmin Belawi is campaigning to stop by publishing today's report into what he and other former members are alleged to have done.
We have testimony that says that Aroub gave direct orders to violently clamp down against nonviolent protests at the University of Aleppo. We have testimony that says that he ordered fellow NUSS members to throw regime-opposing students out of fourth-floor windows at the student residences. So this is a man who should not be representing Syria internationally. He belongs before a courtroom.
That report was by Mike Thompson. Next to Saudi Arabia, where hundreds of people are reported to have died at the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca because of the heat. The Saudi government hasn't released any figures, but several countries have confirmed the deaths of their citizens. According to the AFP news agency, at least 600 Egyptian pilgrims and 68 Indians are amongst the dead. Tim Franks spoke to one pilgrim, Atha Hussein, an imam from central England, who's currently in Mecca.
The experience overall has been wonderful. There is no place on God's earth I'd rather be right now than in Mecca. It's been spiritually uplifting. We brought a group of pilgrims of about 140 from the United Kingdom with our particular group. And it's really strengthened my faith and to really gain an understanding of what it means to be a Muslim. This year, undoubtedly, the temperature and the conditions have played a big part in people's experiences. I think the Met Office here in Saudi Arabia, or its equivalent, the figures they've given about the temperature is perhaps not reflective of how hot it really does feel here. It's considerably hotter. And the traffic on the roads and the fact that there were so many people in dense areas has just made it feel considerably hotter. Having said that, the heat has actually helped in many ways as well. The aches and pains of the walking and going uphill and so forth disappears very quickly because it's so hot here. But at the same time, it's very unfortunate to hear about the tragic loss of lives. There are so many stories, even from the pilgrims who are with me, about what they saw in the streets, in particular last Sunday.
And what sorts of things were people saying to you about last Sunday?
As you were walking, you could not walk 20 yards except you would see someone struggling in the heat. People were doing whatever they could to shade themselves. They were taking water from kind individuals who were giving it out. They were taking shades in hotel receptions. It was harrowing at times. I've never seen so many people struggle collectively.
Was there a sense that the facilities were adequate, that the authorities had done what they could to provide water stations for people, that sort of thing?
The Hajj is a massive logistical challenge. It would be for anyone in any country in the world. I think the authority have done what they could, and they should be applauded for the efforts they have done. I was sent regular text messages at all times throughout the Hajj, telling me what times I should be leaving the hotel and what times I should avoid. They were giving me health advice of how to keep myself cool. When we were in Mina, which is the camp city, the authority put a curfew to ensure people didn't leave the camps between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m., the hottest part of the day. All of the streets where the pilgrims frequented had sprinklers. I think the Saudi authority perhaps do need to start thinking about controlling the numbers of how many pilgrims come each and every year. And this has been discussed in the past. It is a very sensitive issue. But with climate change, perhaps, with the fact that the Hajj is taking place in the summer months, they may need to look into this in more detail. People forget how flexible Sharia really is. When the conditions are extreme, there are certain types of worship during the Hajj which you can delegate to others. If you're frail, if you're wheelchair bound, then you can delegate someone, for example, to perform a ritual on a particular day.
And Atta, you were telling me that this is your third Hajj. I just wonder, I mean, yeah, just from your experience, is it getting hotter? Is it getting tougher to do this pilgrimage?
This is my third journey. I came in 2003 and then 6 years ago in 2018. 6 years ago, I was convinced that the Hajj I performed then was unbelievably difficult. But now, in hindsight, that was quite easy. It's definitely getting harder. Unfortunately, it seems that climate change is affecting each and every part of our global community. From my experiences in the last 2 or 3 weeks, it is affecting the Hajj. It's really traumatic just watching so many people struggle. But at the same time, I saw the best of humanity. I saw people sacrificing sometimes their own safety and security to help the poor, to help the needy, to help the frail. It restored my faith in what it means to be a human.
Athar Hussain, an imam and pilgrim. I spoke to our religion editor, Ali McBall, who has been to the Hajj in Saudi Arabia in the past. He says it's incredibly hard to navigate even without the added pressure of the high temperatures.
There is a lot of walking involved during the day. It is hot at the best of times, but we heard that temperatures reached nearly 52 degrees Celsius. And so it would not be surprising if there is more in terms of the number of people who died this year as compared to last year. And last year, we were still talking about more than 500 people that we know of who died. And those figures came eventually, many weeks after the pilgrimage was over, from individual countries. And even with data missing, we know that hundreds died last year. It is likely, given the temperatures, how exhausting it is to perform some of these rituals over 5 days, that we are likely to see more people have died ultimately.
Aline, what do the authorities do to try to help mitigate the problems of this horrible heat?
It's really difficult in many ways because, for example, one of the rituals is circumambulation of the Grand Mosque that you see, that cube-shaped mosque shrouded in black. And you need to do that 7 times at the very beginning. And yes, they provide water. There is sometimes misters. So as you walk around, you feel water on your skin. But in those kind of temperatures, it's still incredibly difficult. Then there's a walk from the camp and then to Mecca. And then you have to walk between 2 hills in one ritual. And then there's a ritual later on in the Hajj where you have to go to 3 spots where the devil's thought to have appeared and stone the pillars that are there. And in the kind of temperatures we're talking about, there are some things that you can do, and the Saudi authorities do. They have these posts that spread a fine mist over the pilgrims. And there are medical units set up as well. There are always complaints that there isn't enough that's set up by Saudis, that perhaps sometimes they don't always treat people with the respect that they deserve, particularly some of the poorer pilgrims. But there are, for example, now air-conditioned tents in the camp that most people stay in, but some people are not registered to stay in tents. In fact, there are many, many people there who are not registered to perform the Hajj at all, and so are going under the radar, and it is difficult to provide for them as well.
The BBC's religion editor, Ali McBall. The BBC has received more detail on a UN-backed independent report on the actions of Israel and Hamas in the first few months following the October the 7th attack by Hamas. The report was the latest set of findings from the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. Both Israel and Hamas declined to cooperate with the commission. The report's lead investigator, Navi Pillay, is the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She explained her group's key findings to Celia Hatton.
For the October 7th report, the team captured all the information on social media. We called for submissions, interviewed witnesses, and came up with violations committed by Hamas and Palestinian armed groups together with some Palestinian civilians. And we now deemed all those acts as war crimes. We report up to 31st December on Israel's attack on Gaza and Palestinian territories. We set out the facts and say these are war crimes, the crimes against humanity. And they are violations of international human rights law as well.
How did you go about compiling this report? What access did you have to both sides, to Hamas, to the actions of Hamas, and also to the actions of the Israelis? And how did you find evidence for your conclusions?
It is a challenge, and was a challenge. When we are not allowed, we kept sending requests to Israel so that we can have access to investigate on the ground, talk to victims, talk to the families of hostages. There was no response to each of our requests. And how we overcame that is, firstly, we managed to speak to hostages who had been freed. We met with them in Egypt and Turkey. We called for submissions. We got masses of those from people, experts, researchers, and individuals themselves. So the information came to us, even though we can't go there. Mm. It's true. It's true. It's not our preferred way of working. I would have preferred to go and hear directly from victims, witnesses, and those who've suffered and talk to everyone.
We'll get to Israel's response to this report in just a moment. But I want to focus in for a moment on Hamas. Hamas says they were not ever contacted by your commission. A week ago, NewsHour spoke to Hamas spokesperson Osama Hamdan. Let's hear what he had to say.
This report, if it was fair enough, the people who wrote the report were supposed to talk to Hamas directly. They did not. They know how to talk to Hamas. Ignoring the Palestinians, ignoring what had happened with the Palestinians, ignoring the narrative of the Palestinians will not help anyone.
Navi Pillay, how would you respond to that?
We did approach them. We contacted them. I can't give you the exact details now. But thereafter, communication itself started to become difficult. And that's why we couldn't pursue that. So they do know that we were reaching out to them.
Let's turn to Israel's reaction now. Israel has long accused you, Navi Pillay, personally, of having anti-Israel bias. The commission you lead was founded in 2021. And even back then, Israel objected to you heading the commission. How would you respond that you are inherently biased against Israel, those allegations, and critical of its actions, and as such, unfit to head the commission and to lead the investigations underlying this report?
When this commission was originally formed, it's true, they had objections to me. I was never, in the course of my work as High Commissioner for Human Rights, accused of anti-Semitism. This accusation of anti-Semitism only came about after I'd accepted to serve as chair on this commission. At the time, I flippantly said, I seem to be in very distinguished company because they're calling everybody anti-Semitic. You know, instead of addressing the merits of the report and pointing out what's inaccurate or giving us accurate information, I feel that this is a distraction just to label us as anti-Semitic.
The Israelis say it isn't fair for the commission to equate Israel, a democratic government, with Hamas, which they and many Western governments deem a terrorist group. They say that they do carry out investigations into their soldiers' actions on the ground, unlike Hamas. What would you say to that allegation?
Firstly, we're not comparing or drawing parallels. We're relying just on the facts that we found.
But wouldn't you say there's some basis to that, that the Israelis would feel that they are being drawn as an equivalent to Hamas?
Well, we assert very positively that we're not. So nowhere in the report do we do so. We never say one is worse than the other. We just set it out as it happened. A similar criticism was levied by Israel against the ICC when news came out that they were preparing arrest warrants against Hamas leaders and Israeli leaders. So I doubt the prosecutor of the ICC is drawing a comparison. He's looking at facts on the ground and determining his charges accordingly.
The BBC has tried to contact the Israeli government for a response to the report and to that interview, but we've heard nothing back yet. The leader of the Lebanese Islamist movement, Hezbollah, has threatened Cyprus, warning it not to provide military help for Israel. Hassan Nasrallah said the nearby island would be treated as a warring party if it allowed the Israeli Air Force to use its bases to attack Lebanon during any wider conflict. Hassan Nasrallah was addressing a ceremony to honour a senior Hezbollah commander, Taleb Abdallah, who was killed last week in an Israeli airstrike. John Donaldson is in Jerusalem.
Hassan Nasrallah said that no part of Israel would be safe if there was an all-out war and that Israel could expect to be attacked from the land, the sea and the air. And this came after some comments by senior military officials here in Israel last night, saying that they had authorised a plan, I suppose, for an all-out invasion if that were necessary. But I think at this stage, it is still largely a talking up of the rhetoric, and that's something the Americans have been very keen to dial down. They had their envoy over here over the past week in both Israel and Lebanon, but it doesn't seem to have worked.
John Donison. Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un have signed what the Russian president described as a breakthrough mutual security pact. The deal was made on a day of carefully stage-managed events during Mr. Putin's first visit to North Korea for over 20 years. Well, during his visit, Mr. Putin was treated to lavish formal ceremonies featuring goose-stepping honor guards, smiling children, and a release of balloons into the air. Mr. Kim said he unconditionally supported Russia's military action in Ukraine. Analysts are now poring over the details of the agreement. What, for example, do the two countries mean by mutual assistance in the event of aggression? Laura Bicker is our correspondent in Beijing. Here's her take on the Moscow-Pyongyang deal.
North Korea and Russia are fast friends. They're not firm friends. This is not a relationship that they have prioritised in the past. When Kim Jong-un was undergoing his whirlwind diplomacy in 2018 and 2019, he met Donald Trump 3 times. He met President Xi 3 times. He met the South Korean president 3 times. He met Vladimir Putin once. This is transactional. They need something from one another right now. But how deep that cooperation will go, certainly many will be looking at this agreement to try to find out. Now, why is China a limit on this relationship? Well, China looks at this relationship with a wary eye. So far, they're even unwilling to comment on it. They've sent a delegation currently to Seoul working on various partnerships. So that might be to kind of assuage Seoul at this time and reassure them that they are still here and that they feel certainly that they are independent. Yes, China is a strategic ally of both Russia and North Korea, but it wants to be a global power. Right now, it needs the West and it needs Europe. It does not want to be sanctioned for its relationship with Russia and North Korea. And when it comes to kind of diplomacy, certainly we've seen a rush of Chinese diplomacy, both President Xi heading to Europe and recently in Australia. They are urging visa-free travel for tourists. They're even sending pandas. So when it comes to that global-facing China, they do not want to be seen in this same axis with North Korea, with Russia. They will not want the West to look over this way, over east, and see an axis of evil. And that is why I say at this time, Beijing is wary of this relationship, and perhaps both Mr. Putin and Mr. Kim will not want to cross any of Mr. Xi's red lines.
Laura Bicker in China. Researchers here in the UK have shed new light on why some people don't get COVID-19. In what's being claimed as a world first, a number of healthy people who had never had COVID were deliberately exposed to the virus that causes the disease. The study found their immune systems responded in a novel way. Dr. Marko Nikolic from University College London co-led the study. He told me more about it.
We're very surprised that out of the 16 volunteers who had the COVID virus sprayed up their noses, not everyone ended up testing positive for COVID. We divided these volunteers into different groups. Most of them developed classical COVID and tested several times positive. Then 3 volunteers just had an odd positive test. And then there was this group of 7 participants who, despite being challenged, never developed a positive test result. And you might obviously now wonder what's so special about them. Well, we have identified some special immune cells who go up and down specifically in that group. We've also shown that there's a quicker immune infiltration in the nose in those volunteers who've only had a non-sustained infection, so who didn't test PCR positive all the time. We also identified a new gene called HLA-DQA2. In essence, we showed the expression of that gene in those who did not develop classical COVID was very high. So we could potentially use this as a biomarker of protection. So essentially, we could go into the community and see who are the people who have already high expression of that gene, and those are the people who might be protected.
So looking ahead, You have these people who may have that particular gene which gives them particular immune cells. But what about for the broader community? How might this help develop new treatments in the future, do you think?
The most important thing is that we now know how our bodies react to a new virus in unprecedented detail and how different cell types in the nose and blood respond to the viral infection from pre-infection all the way in regular intervals afterwards. And we can use this new information to compare our data to other data we're actually planning to generate, specifically what happens to other strains of COVID, then also what happens to volunteers who've been already vaccinated or been naturally infected, as most of us are, virtually all of us have some sort of immunity against COVID, and then also to other viruses. If we then analyze what is different in those who already have immunity to this paper we published, where volunteers have never been exposed to the virus, then we might be able to identify novel ways of inducing protection other than just with vaccines. And certainly it will also help us with the developing of novel vaccines for future pandemics. Essentially, we're trying to be better prepared for the next pandemic.
Dr. Marko Nikolic from University College London. Still to come.
Step one, take wood. Step two, put wood on fire.
I've been a busy boy and I need a break.
Fancy a dream job in Tasmania? You're going to have to do a few unusual tasks in return.
Would you like to escape into the British countryside for encounters with the wild world? The podcast from BBC Countryfile magazine is a weekly adventure into beautiful landscapes to meet wildlife, discuss the big nature stories with guests, and find welcome tranquility in a busy world. We take you on thrilling quests and charming rambles so that you can enjoy the great outdoors wherever you are. So join me, Fergus Collins, each week as we escape into the great British countryside together. Search for the podcast and follow us to never miss an episode.
The Philippines has accused Chinese Coast Guard personnel of being armed with swords, spears and knives during an incident in contested waters in the South China Sea. This appears to be an escalation from previous skirmishes. Nikki Bristow reports.
The Philippines has given more details about an encounter that happened on Monday. It said Chinese vessels rammed, surrounded and towed its boats. Chinese personnel, armed with weapons such as knives, boarded the boats and confiscated rifles. One Philippine soldier lost a thumb. China responded by saying its personnel were professional and restrained. Over the last year, there have been a series of clashes involving Coast Guard vessels from the two countries in the South China Sea. But this seems more serious.
Mickey Bristow. Protesters against climate change have sprayed orange paint on Britain's best-known ancient monument, Stonehenge. It's a prehistoric megalithic structure on Salisbury Plain in southern England, consisting of an outer ring of vertical standing stones topped by connecting horizontal lintel structures. At the 5,000-year-old landmark, visitors could be heard shouting no as the two men defaced it. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, described it as a disgraceful act of vandalism. Jonathan Fido reports.
Two protesters began spraying the iconic stones with the orange substance around 12 p.m. this lunchtime. Wearing white T-shirts with the Just Stop Oil logo, they said they wanted the incoming government to work with other governments and stop the extraction and burning of oil, gas and coal by 2030. Members of the public were seen trying to prevent the action by dragging them away. Several of the stones, though, were sprayed.
Jonathan Fido. Now, are cryptic crosswords getting too old? The accusation has been made that the puzzle setters in devising clues are stuck in a so-called baby boomer mindset to the exclusion of more youthful cultural references. Is that really the case? Is it a problem? Evan Davis spoke to a cryptic crossword puzzle setter and a user. Dave Gorman has written crosswords for various newspapers, and Katie Steckles is an accomplished cryptic crossword puzzler. Evan first asked Dave if he thinks about any particular demographic group when writing a cryptic crossword.
I don't really think about it. I think I write about the world that I inhabit. And the truth is, I'm a 50-something-year-old man, so there are bound to be some things in there that are 50-year-old man related, just because that's who I am. I guess I make a conscious effort to include some cultural references that are of today. And I deliberately write clues that will have things like Beyonce or Simon Cowell or One Direction in them, not because I think, oh, that's better, but because I do think I want someone who glances at it in their paper to think, oh, I thought it was all Shakespeare and Greek myths. Oh, that's interesting. Maybe this is a bit more for me. And I think there is a weird thing that goes on where people assume that young people only know about today, whereas actually, in my experience, young people know far more about the whole pantheon of music than we ever did.
Well, Katie, as someone who is an enthusiast of the cryptic crossword, what is your experience? Do you find there are references from old school crossword setters whose references are incomprehensible to you?
Well, I think it depends on which crosswords you're looking at. So, you know, a lot of people think of crosswords as being the things that are in the newspapers. I mean, whether young people these days even read newspapers, I don't know. But, you know, a lot of the sort of traditional long-standing crosswords in the papers kind of have to use broad references that they know everyone will know. I've seen a huge variety of things from, you know, very, very up-to-date references about, you know, memes that have just happened on the internet. But then also, yeah, it's great to learn about historical things and about poems from the past or geographical landmarks and things that are referenced in crosswords. So it's, you know, it's all game, right? It's part of the puzzle.
Part of the puzzle. I suppose that is right. But when you sit and think about which crossword you're going to attempt, do you know what the references are of that particular puzzle? Do you think, oh, this one tends to be a bit more youthful, or this one's a bit old school?
If you can see who the setter is for a crossword, you'll know sort of a bit what to expect. You can get used to a particular setter's style and the kinds of things they tend to do. You know, some of them have a bit more of a playful style, have a bit more fun with it, and some of them are a bit more down the line. And I guess certain crosswords in certain papers have particular rules and styles, and that you get to know them and you get to sort of have a feel for it. I think a lot of the thing about the way people get into solving cryptic crosswords, there are a lot of sort of conventions and traditions that you almost kind of just have to learn. And a lot of people I know learn to solve cryptics by doing them with other people. So it's almost like a hereditary pastime that you kind of have to pick up from someone else. Right. But, you know, nowadays people are sharing those kinds of insights online in TikTok videos and kind of telling each other, you know, this is what I did, this is how I solved this one. And you can kind of pick it up that way as well. So it's kind of democratized it a lot more.
Yeah. Dave, are there many young crossword puzzle setters like yourself? Is this a rather aging pastime, I suppose?
The fact that you said like yourself, I'm going to take as a huge compliment because I'm in my 50s. So I don't actually know many other setters. I communicate with some of them online. I genuinely have no idea how old most of them are. But actually, I think it is a world that slowly moves and keeps pace.
That was a puzzle setter, Dave Gorman, and before him, Katie Steckles, an accomplished cryptic crossword puzzler. Now to what's being called the dream job advert. It invites you to close your computer, leave your desk and head to Tasmania, an island that lies 240 kilometres to the south of the Australian mainland. Your travel, accommodation and food will all be paid for, but you're going to have to do a few unusual tasks in return. Alfie Habershon has been looking at the options.
Stop your day job for an odd job!
The trailer pans over the island's gleaming rocky coast, with mountains and forests stretching over into the horizon. And apparently it's all free, as long as you take on at least one of these 10 odd jobs.
Step one, take wood. Step two, put wood on fire.
I've been a busy boy and I need a break.
OK, so if running an outdoor sauna, arranging freshly caught oysters or rolling up your sleeves in the engine room of a steam train all sound a bit tiring, you could use your musical ability to get out of it by joining the orchestra performing inside the island's large caves. Or, if you're used to having a dog, there's another four-legged animal in need of daily walks. A wombat, of course. Well, hopefully one a bit calmer than that one. And it's all part of Tasmania's push to boost tourism during the winter, and is targeted at mainland Australians, who currently have a record 200 million days of unused annual leave. The website urges you to find one of the tasks that speaks to you and send in 50 words explaining why you want to leave your normal life behind.
Stop your day job for an odd job.
Yum.
Alfie Habershon, a potential winter resident of Tasmania. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Would you like to escape into the British countryside for encounters with the wild world? The podcast from BBC Country Farm magazine is a weekly adventure into beautiful landscapes to meet wildlife, discuss the big nature stories with guests, and find welcome tranquility in a busy world. We take you on thrilling quests and charming rambles so that you can enjoy the great outdoors wherever you are. So join me, Fergus Collins, each week as we escape into the great British countryside together. Search for the podcast and follow us to never miss an episode.